Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The first New Hampshire primary happened exactly 100 years ago. And I think now there's a case to be made that the quadrennial American political spectacle is getting a little long in the tooth. Today's New Hampshire primary is much whiter than the rest of the country. The power of super PACs and outside money can make Granite State retail politics feel a little quaint. And then there's this, my favorite line from David Shribman's Weekend Boston Globe article about the primary. He writes that, quote, Gary Hart once said that more lies were told in the bar of the old Sheraton Wayfarer in Bedford than in any other room in America. And yet, Shribman also makes the case that the New Hampshire primary remains a relevant, influential, and deeply important part of the process we go through to pick a president, but not for the reasons you might think. David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and former Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe. He joins us now from Pittsburgh. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, I'm glad to be home, at least on the radio.
We're glad to have you back here in New England. So let me ask you, I mean, you're in Pittsburgh now, but your article was so beautifully written, so insightful, and I have to say warmly critical, but, you know, warmly knowing about the idiosyncrasies of New Hampshire. Why is it that you're still obsessed with the primary after all these years?
Well, I think it's the idiosyncrasy of it that draws me and draws so many people. Yes, New Hampshire's unrepresentative. Yes, it doesn't have even one huge city. Yes, it's a different kind of place with a different kind of tradition, but that's all the reasons why it may have endured, all the reasons that it may well yet endure. I think what the main point here, Thomas Rath, former Attorney General of New Hampshire, made this point in my piece, that this may be the last time the next President of the United States sits down in a coffee shop and listens to what happened, to the stories of people who are deeply committed to knowing about the campaign and who have lives and stories that they want to tell. It's still an intimate, even in the Trump era, even in the big media era, even in the social media era, it's still a pretty intimate affair. I've been to several events this time, and of course in Iowa as well, and it's still an opportunity for people one-on-one to talk to candidates. And you know, Adlai Stevenson said in 1952, that a presidential campaign was an education in America. I think New Hampshire still plays an education role.
Right. I mean, you write that you say that New Hampshire primary voters serve as the collective memory for the political history of the whole country.
Well, that's right. And even though so many of them are from Massachusetts now, even though New Hampshire is so much less remote than it was when I was a child or even when I was a college student, and I was a college student in New Hampshire. And in that period, we could only get one television station, and that was only if the wind was going the right place, and it was from another state. Of course, that's a whole other era. You know, when one went to New Hampshire in those days, even in the 70s and 80s, it was a culture apart. It had a governor who thought it ought to have nuclear weapons. It had two great universities, or colleges and universities, but generally speaking, it was a world apart. It was remote. When my father went to college in New Hampshire, and he lived in Salem, Massachusetts, it took 8 hours to drive from Salem, Massachusetts to Hanover, New Hampshire.
Wow.
Now you can do it in 2 hours and 12 minutes or 15.
Yeah, depending on traffic, though.
Depending on traffic on the first half of it, that's
yeah.
Right.
Well, David, let me ask you. I do have some more skeptical questions for you about the relevance of the primary today.
I'm skeptical. Go ahead.
I'm going to get to those in just a second, though, because I do want you to share a story or two that you write in the article. And by the way, we have a link to David's article at radioboston.org, because you talk about how there have been moments over these past 100 years where the New Hampshire primary goes from being this place of, you know, personal, intimate retail politics to suddenly flowering into something that's much bigger. It has much larger repercussions. And for example, you say in 1968, John Kerry, obviously not into presidential politics at that time, but he wrote about the 68 New Hampshire primary where Eugene McCarthy took 42% of the vote. Kerry called it a grassroots prairie fire in terms of those who wanted to send a message to Washington about Vietnam.
Well, prairie fire, of course, we should tell the Secretary of State, is a metaphor better used in Iowa than New Hampshire.
Right.
But nonetheless, the notion, and this was before there was an Iowa caucus in 1968. The first one was in 72 or 76, I think 72. Excuse me. But the notion of getting clean for Gene McCarthy, and by getting clean, I mean college students, men mostly, shaving, you know, putting on their nice clothes, going door-to-door in Derry and Dover and West Lebanon and Conway and every place else for Gene McCarthy. That was an earthquake. Now, President Johnson won that primary because I think he had 47 or 48, but Gene McCarthy had 42. It was an earthquake in American politics, and it changed everything. There are other examples. Gary Hart's victory in 1984 ended the notion that Walter Mondale, the vice president, former vice president's nomination was itself inevitable. He did finally win that, but only after a struggle, and only after he had to answer very important questions about his own campaign and his own outlook. New Hampshire made him do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we come to Bill Clinton, who almost was eliminated the week before the New Hampshire primary when news came out about his extramarital affair. He came back and was able to claim he was the winner, when those of us who study this carefully and have good memories know that Paul Tsongas really won that.
But the comeback kid label stuck,
comeback
though.
Comeback kid label. And, of course, his wife used the comeback routine as well in 2008, having lost in Iowa, and then came back and won in New Hampshire and gave perhaps the greatest Hillary speech ever delivered.
Yeah. You know, but I wonder, because that's one of the things that several people in your article talked about, that New Hampshire provides politics on a human scale, right? But it makes me think that, you know, in this day and age, how much does that human scale really matter anymore, when the scale of money, of super PACs, of you know, the other organizations surrounding a candidate seems to so incredibly dwarf you know, the town hall meetings that might be happening on a hourly basis at this point in time in New Hampshire?
Well, but the fact is, there still are those hourly meetings. Now, I guarantee you that Donald Trump will be going, maybe not door to door, maybe not town to town, but he will have town meeting sessions next week or week after, in the week between Iowa and New Hampshire. He'll be doing some of that retail politics. Surely John Kasich has based his entire campaign on that. So too has Bernie Sanders, whom I saw in Exeter in the summer. Jeb Bush is doing the same thing. So I think that, for example, somebody will come out of New Hampshire as the alternative to Trump and Cruz. And so that person will have won that position by virtue of those very, very intimate affairs.
Yeah. You know, I followed John Huntsman around a little bit when he was running.
Oh, President Huntsman, yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he put all his eggs in the New Hampshire basket, and he...
Well, we've seen that before. So did Bruce Babbitt.
Yeah.
And others, yeah.
And to what end, though? I mean, what difference...
Yeah, but just because you don't win doesn't mean the contest isn't valuable. I mean, you can ask Bill Belichick that question today.
Fair enough.
Should he not have bothered to go to Denver? Did they not make a statement of some sort by coming back that way? I think that's a relevant comparison.
I suppose it would have been a different question had Huntsman won, right?
And it would have been a different question had the Patriots won.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you. There's you write a beautiful line, many beautiful lines in the piece, but there's one in particular where I think it's either you or someone you quote describes New Hampshire today even as being something of a Currier and Ives print frozen in the mid-19th century. And it definitely can have that feel. I mean, I spend weeks up there every year, you know, in the summer especially, on vacation, and I love it. But on the other hand, the rest of America no longer so Currier and Ives. So, I mean, are we doing the rest of America a disservice by putting so much weight on this one little corner of New England? No offense, Granite Staters.
Well, no offense to anyone, but I mean, there's a lot in America that's different from the 19th century, from Currier and Ives, from those Bartlett prints that you can buy from once in a while if you see them in an antique store or an estate sale. But that doesn't, just because it's old doesn't mean it's bad. Just because it's old-fashioned doesn't mean it's bad. And I know I sound like a raging conservative here, but really I'm showing respect for the past and respect for the beauty of the American experience and the notion, you know, Old Home Week was invented in the end of the 19th century by a New Hampshire governor who wanted to bring people from New Hampshire back into the state. You know, there are Old Home Weeks all across the country right now. We lived in the Reagan years of 8 years of an Old Home Week in a national scale. We ought not to be in a hurry to abandon the traditions that made us a great country.
Yeah, you know, there is a lot to be said about, as you write, these traditions, rituals, as you point out, political rituals at the end of your piece. But I want to come back to that Gary Hart quote about all those lies told in Bedford.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I can't remember what election it was. One in several years past, I went to a Newt Gingrich rally in Manchester, and he had been talking about how he had been further up north in New Hampshire. And at that time, all the people he met were telling him that their number one issue was the Northern Pass, right? They didn't want these huge electrical lines coming down from Canada, cutting right through the middle of New Hampshire to power Boston. And Newt Gingrich easily told the crowd, he's like, hey, yeah, we'll have some guys look into burying the lines in the Northern Pass. I promise you, we'll do that if I become president. I mean, ultimately, that's actually what happened, not because of Newt Gingrich. But my point is, like, he was basically willing, it seemed to me, to say almost anything to that audience. So
I'm not sure somebody sitting in a Boston studio in the day after the Patriots game should be talking disparagingly about the Northern Pass. But nonetheless, there's a lot of sucking up that goes into political candidates and campaigns. And if you don't believe me, go to Iowa and mention ethanol.
Yeah.
Okay? Okay, so I mean, and then go to New York and mention such and such, and go to the Rio Grande and mention immigration, and go to Florida and mention Social Security, and then duck, of course. So I mean, that's not something that troubles me. What might trouble me is the notion that candidates are trying to do the New Hampshire thing without doing the New Hampshire thing. It doesn't usually work. It may work this time, but I doubt it, because even Trump is doing the New Hampshire thing, and surely Mrs. Clinton is doing so, and so is Bernie Sanders. So I think we're seeing them campaign. This is the way I think we should look at it. They're all running for governor of New Hampshire, and they're running gubernatorial campaigns. You know, and who's well-suited to run a gubernatorial campaign? Well, Governor Bush, Governor Kasich, Governor Christie. I would look to them to do better than expected because they know how to run gubernatorial campaigns.
Yeah. Well, that takes me back, though, to the Tom Rath quote that you shared with us in the beginning of the conversation, that this may be one of the last times that the person who goes on to become the president of the United States actually has extended one-on-one conversations with average Americans. You know, if you're sitting in California watching what's going on in New Hampshire, does that give you any solace if you don't necessarily feel the same sense of, you don't feel like you're the same average American as someone in Dixville Notch?
If you're sitting in Los Angeles, you're accustomed to the notion of a political rally being three people sitting in front of a television set watching a negative ad. I just think it's a big part of a candidate's education to be able to see America and to talk to America on this scale. I just talked a few minutes ago to Terry Schumacher, who was a national committeeman from New Hampshire, and he was saying the same thing, that there you're at least forced to you're at least forced to confront people one-on-one. Now, let's also, before we end this, let's talk about some of the stupidity and fun and folklore of all of this. You know, when you see Estes Kefauver, who is as dapper a gentleman as possible, you know, riding in a dog sled, and the best, my favorite, absolute favorite is the famous Eisenstadt picture in Life magazine from 1952 of Mr. Republican, Senator Bob Taft of Ohio, holding a chicken. Now, he looked like a complete fool. And I think there's something about a ritual that makes Bob Taft look like a fool.
Yeah.
Not only Republicans look like fools, Democrats look like fools as well from time to time. And I think there's an awfully salutary effect when you make some of these high and mighty people look silly and look foolish. And I think New Hampshire has that capacity as well.
Well, I'm going to close our conversation with a final quote from your piece, because you remind us how William Loeb, the publisher of what was then the Manchester Union Leader, at various times called candidates, I mean, talk about speaking truth to power, stupid, conceited jackasses, that was for Joe Biden, a jerk, that was for Gerald Ford, a boob, that was for Senator Henry Jackson, Moscow Muskie, that was for Edmund Muskie of Maine, and Chihuahua George for Governor George Romney of Michigan. Only in New Hampshire. That's the thought I'm going to leave with you.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad we talked.
David Shrivman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and former Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. We've got a link to his article about the idiosyncrasies of the New Hampshire website, New Hampshire primary at radioboston.org. David, thanks again.
Oh, thank you so much.